Oh, I think I'm okay, right, David? You can hear me? All right, buddy, I'm Jimmy, alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober, and I always like to start with a prayer before we start this on a Saturday morning. On awakening, we consider our plans for the day. And I don't think Bill was talking about what we have to do. I think who we're going to be. And I love, Jay, your meditation touched my heart so much today. And I'll talk about that in a second. But so I always like to just set the table here, right? And on who am I going to be today, right? And what are some of the things I want to strive for? And what are some of the things I want to inspire to be, right? So I use this little retreat book. This is a very old book. If anyone ever wants one of these, if you hear me, you know, just let me know and I'll get it to you. But there's a book of prayers. It was written by four recovering priests in New Jersey. We have a retreat house in New Jersey. Some of these guys have been there. The Redemptorist. Don't ask me what that is. They're the Redemptorist. It's like the mafia. The Redemptorist, the Jesuits, the Franciscans. But it says, God of my life, I welcome this new day. It's your gift to me, the first day of the rest of my life. I thank you for the gift of being alive this morning. I thank you for the sleep which has refreshed me. I thank you for the chance to begin life all over again. Lord, this day is full of promise and of opportunity. Help me to waste none of it. This day is full of mystery and of the unknown. Help me to face it without fear or anxiety. This day is full of beauty and adventure. Help me to be fully alive to it all. During this day, may I become a more thoughtful person, a prayerful person, a more generous and kindly person. May I not be turned in on myself, but be sensitive and helpful to others. Let me do nothing today that will harm anyone. Rather, let me help at least a little to make life more pleasant for those who are about me. When night comes, may I look back on this day without regret. May nobody be unhappy because of anything I have done or anything I have failed to do. Lord, bless this day for me and for all of us. Make it a day in which we grow more in knowing and carrying out your will. Dear God, I spend so much time reliving yesterday or anticipating tomorrow, I lose sight of the only time that is really mine, the present moment. You give me today one moment at a time. That's all I have, all I'll ever have. Give me the faith to know that each moment contains exactly what is best for me. Give me the hope to trust you enough so that I may forget past failures and future trials, and give me the love to make each moment an anticipation of living forever with you. O Lord, support us all the day long until shadows lengthen and the evening comes, until the busy world is hushed and the fever of life is over and our work is done. Then in your mercy, grant us safe lodging and holy rest and peace in your heart. Amen. Wow. It's a long prayer. If you want it, let me know and I'll give it to you. I could text it to you, I could email it to you, I could mail it to you if you need. So me and Tommy are going to talk about daddy issues, right? And we're not up here to beat up our old man. I mean, you heard our stories last night. You know, I was thinking about a thing that David's sponsor says all the time, Ralph White. You know, when I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, how's he put it now? I forget what he says. Walking into grace doesn't feel like walking into grace. Felt like I was walking out of total chaos in my life. I didn't understand the enormity of what was going to happen to me. You know, my idea was I'm walking into this thing. I don't know what AA is. This guy says he'll help me in some way. I don't even know what's wrong with me yet. But I walk into my first meeting. I don't understand that my life's going to be transformed if I stay. I mean, that takes time, right? And how does it transform? And I think of the AA story. The best thing we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is the identification, the story, the AA story. And my story's not for everyone in this room. I know that. I'm not that foolish. And your story's not for, you know, it's not supposed to be. That's why we have so many stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But the identification, do I think like that? Do I feel like that? Do I drink like that? And my world started to open up very slowly. And through the years, I've heard most, like many in this room, the most unbelievable stories, right? Just heart-moving, heart-wrenching. It just changed me, you know? And there was a guy that, you know, I know Tommy's going to talk about, and I know a lot of you guys in this room, and I'm sure he did this retreat at some point. His name was Howard P., Howard Pullens from Arizona. And Howard, he was a character, as many of you know, and, you know, we can go, I could spend the next half hour talking about some of his story, but he used to tell this story that I thought that was the most stupidest thing ever, the baby elephant story. And a lot of you guys might have heard that story, you know, and he would talk about, you know, growing up in the 30s in Kansas and living on a farm, and he's watching a documentary back then and how to raise baby elephants, you know, and what they would do is they would tie a rope around the elephant's foot and then tie it to the tree, and the elephant would move around it. As quick as that rope got tight, the elephant would stop walking. And so the trainer throughout the years, and I'm probably butchering this story, but the trainer throughout the years would keep on reinforcing that idea that when the elephant moved and the rope got tight, stop moving. Well, now he goes to the end of the story. He talks about the big elephant, the elephant that has now grown into an adult elephant. He's so strong, he could pull the tree right out of the forest if he needed to. But they tie a rope around this elephant's right leg, and they tie it to a stake that's into the ground. And the elephant has all that freedom to move around, but when that rope gets tight, that's it. He stops walking. Now, the moral of that story, I believe, was it the rope that made him stop? Or was it the stake that made him stop? Or was it the limited belief system that was put in his head when he was a young child that this elephant's going to stop? And how many of us walk into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous with baby elephant ideas, baby elephant belief systems, old ideas like I talked about yesterday? And what I've learned throughout the years is that in order to get free in here, I have to start unlearning a lot of old ideas. I have to start looking at some belief systems and challenging some of the belief systems that I've been walking around with that were put in by my mom, my dad, people, teachers, you name it, right? And not every old idea is a bad idea, but I got to take a look at it because some of that stuff is dominant in my mind. And I wonder why I am the way I am. I wonder why I'm always angry. I wonder why I'm always filled with fear. I always wonder why, you know, all these things are going on in my life and I have no explanation for it. But when I start to look at some of these old ideas, these things that are so down beneath the surface, the subconsciousness, right? Bill Wilson talks, I love that language of root and branch. You know, where are the roots? Under the ground. I don't see it. And if you keep on living this way, practicing this way, thinking this way over a 20, 30, 40-year period of time, you believe it's true. And so one of the biggest old belief systems I had was about my old man. I hated this guy. No, I love this guy. I just didn't understand this guy, you know? And growing up in my house, you know, like I said last night, you know, he was a heavy drinker, and then one day the doctors came to him, I think he was about 57 years old, and they said to him, hey, you know, if you keep drinking, we're going to start cutting things off, because he got diabetes 1, I guess that's what you call it, right? And my old man had the ability to put the plug in the jug and never drink again, but that didn't change his attitude. It made him even more angrier, made him even more crazier. He didn't have what we have. He didn't have a sponsor, a prayer life, a home group, or any of that kind of stuff. You know, he was just running on self-will his whole time. And he was just a tornado that roared through the house for many years. So, you know, I'm about 15 years old. I have two brothers that are older to me. The day they hit graduation out of high school and went to college, they never came back. So my brother went off to Boston College. My other brother went to New York City to an art institute. He was a Pratt Institute he went to. My sister went to Boston College. She was the next one before me. And then I'm left with the wolf at home, me and my little sister. And my old man doesn't know how to handle a guy like me because I'm a street guy right from the young age. And I'm bringing home stuff to him and my family or him and my mom that, you know, he was baffled by my behavior, that I would be the kid I was and getting in trouble and all that stuff. So I'm about 15 years old, and I'm starting to play sports a lot. I'm playing football. I remember trying out for freshman football. I made the team. I'm in the weight room. I'm getting strong. I was always a big guy, you know. But I remember like it happened this morning. My old man's right in front of me, right where Bill is, and he's yelling at me about something, right? And he goes to throw a punch at me, and I grab the punch, and he never swung his fist at me again. He knew he had no chance against me, that I was strong enough to stand up for myself, you know? And I tell you that because, you know, somewhere along the line, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the ice started to melt between me and my old man. Something happened in my house where my old man got very interested in my recovery. You know, I think he was baffled by you because I would bring guys like you home, not in so much your presence, but more in your stories. And I would talk about Tommy. I would talk about Jay. I would talk about Bill, you know? And one of the things I wanted to mention in your meditation was, you know, I didn't understand the enormity of this because I am a self-hater. And when you went like this morning and said, I love you, that took me a long time in these rooms to even, like, say that about myself. Because I am so driven by old ideas and just that internal nonsense that goes on in all of us. So here I am. I get sober. I'm bringing you guys home. The ice is starting to melt between us. He's asking me questions, you know. Something is starting to form between me and my old man, right? Very shallow. A lot of times I walk in the house, hey, did you watch a Yankee game last night? Yeah, did you watch a football game last night? Yeah, you know. Start a little conversation, right? So I'm about 18 months sober, and I'm, you know, my life's getting a little bit better, right? I'm 18 months sober. I'm with you guys, right? I have a home group. I have a, you know, I'm back with that wife, you know, and I got a job, and I'm working on the midnight shift, and I come home off a midnight shift. And what I used to do back then was I would stop at my parents' house and bring them coffee or the newspaper. You know, we used to read newspapers, believe it or not. You know, I bring them that kind of stuff, maybe some bagels or something. And I walk in the house 18 months sober, and I find my father dead on the ground right there. Boom. 63 years old, 4 years younger than I am now. Heavy smoker, 4 packs a day, Camel, no filter. Right? And so he's laying on the ground. Now, I come from an age in Alcoholics Anonymous when, especially when you live in a big city, there's 12-step calls available every day. And a 12-step call back then, for you young guys who might not all know this, you know, my sponsor would call me up 11 o'clock at night. 10 minutes downstairs. That's all he would say. You know, it wasn't like I got to work, I'm having sex with my wife or anything like that. No, 10 minutes downstairs. And so we'd go downstairs, and it'd be my sponsor, Richie, another old-timer, and then it'd be me and another young guy. And we'd go to someone's house, you know, 11 o'clock at night. And we get to that house, and we all had a role. My role was, you know, Jimmy, go look for guns, go look for weapons, see if there's anything laying around, because this could turn sideways. You know, he'd tell the other guy, like, say a guy like Tommy, go check on the wife, go check on the kids, make sure they're okay. And then we watched her magic. And what the magic was, with the old two old-timers would go in that living room and sit on that couch, and they would tell their stories to this alcoholic. And back then, you know, we didn't have a treatment center on every corner or a detox in every corner. We grabbed that guy, we asked him the $64,000 question, you want help? Yeah, let's go. And we bring him to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all those guys back then, they carried a pint or half a pint of whiskey in their glove compartment. I'm like, we could do that? He goes, not you. I thought that was my out. You know, and so I'm in tune to the cry of the alcoholic who's still sick and suffering. So here I am, I'm in my house, and there's my father. He's dead on the ground. I call up my sponsor. He goes, hey, call 911 and let's pray. He's praying. I call 911 and I'm crying. And I'm looking at my dad. He didn't even look like him. And all of a sudden, the first cop pulls in. And the cop's taking down the information. And he looks at me and goes, hey, I don't see you walking the streets anymore. I said, yeah, I don't do that anymore. Taking down a little bit more information. He looks at me and goes, matter of fact, I don't even see you drinking on the corner or drinking on the bars anymore. I go, yeah, I don't do that. He goes, well, how do you do that? I go to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 18 months sober, and apparently it's helping me, and it's working. And all of a sudden, this cop starts to talk to me about his drinking. He's talking about the unmanageability of his life and how he's jammed up on the job. He's talking about once he takes that first one, he can't stop. He's talking about all the effects of what happens when we're drinking. You all know that story. And I could hear the voice. I could hear the sound of help, or needing help, the cry of the alcoholic. And all of a sudden, I'm 12-stepping this cop over my dead father's body. And that guy didn't live in my town, even though he was a cop in my town. He lived in another town. I told him, after I told him about my story, I said, listen, in your town, there's a meeting. I've been to that meeting. And there's a bunch of great guys in that meeting. And if you go to that meeting and you meet these guys, they could help you out. And I left it at that. And that was it. About 2 years ago in my home group. I have a big home group. It's like 300 people. Sunday night, big book study. The girls are over there reading. The guys are over there reading. I'm up front lying about something to my sponsees. And I get a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around. And there's this guy standing in front of me. He goes, I've been looking for you. I said, really? He goes, yeah, I heard you moved and I moved and I haven't lost contact with you. And I'm like, well, who are you? He goes, I'm the police officer that was with you on the day your dad died. And I've been looking for you because I want to tell you something. I said, what's that? He goes, I went to that meeting you told me about that next day after we talked. And I met those guys that you told me to talk to. And they helped me. And I'm here to let you know that I just celebrated 34 years of sobriety. Yeah, baby. Now, I don't have the power to get anyone drunk and I don't have the power to get anyone sober. But God will use you without your permission. And my first spiritual truth was revealed to me that in order to get out of the darkness of my life, I got to serve others. And that's really been the mantra throughout my sobriety. That if I really want to be free, I got to help others. And one of the things I need to be free of is about this relationship with my old man. Right? There was a lot of things about my father that I did not understand. And I'll never forget, you know, my mom sent me down and, you know, she started to talk about my dad about things I never even knew. And one of the things I didn't know was that my grandfather was a drunk. My dad was from Budapest, Hungary. His dad was a rancher. And his dad died from alcoholism at 38 years old. And my mother pulled a picture out of my grandfather, who I didn't even know. And I'm telling you guys, if I showed you this picture, you would think it's me at like some amusement park dressed like a rancher from Budapest, Hungary. I mean, it was identical. It was like I was looking in the mirror with a handlebar mustache. That was the only thing different, right? And my mom told me when he died, and my dad and his brother and his sister came to the United States, my dad at a young age had to start working. He didn't have a childhood like I had and all the gifts that I had and all the sports that I played. He didn't have any of this. So he had to go to work. And when he was 17 years old, he had to join the Navy. And he did his time in Alaska in the Navy. Brian, thank you. And who else? Where is he? Tony. That's a little side story. I drift once in a while. Don't worry. But what I started to understand is about my dad. You know? My dad came out of the Navy, and his brother owned a butcher shop, and my dad and went right into business being a butcher. Now, I ate good growing up. But there were so many things revealed to me that I didn't understand about my father. Somewhere along the lines, my niece came to my house, or my parents' house, and my dad used to have 8mm film. I don't know if you, well, you young guys can Google that. I don't mind if you pull out your phone. But they used to have these cameras, and my dad would take these, and then he'd have them in his drawers, and it would be all the, by dates and times. I mean, it was just like, almost like an OCD type of thing, right? And on those things, I had no idea what was on those things. And so my niece came to us and said, hey, listen, I like to digitize all this stuff and put it on a CD. And we said, fine, here, take them all. We don't care. My mother didn't care, right? And so like 2 years later, we're at a Thanksgiving at my cousin's house in northern New Jersey. And it's the big reveal. She wants to put the CD in so we could all see whatever she's putting together from all these 8mm films. And it's the story of my father. I had it all wrong. I had it all wrong about my old man. I don't remember the vacations, because I remember the beatings. I don't remember the ball games, because I remember the beatings. I don't remember the vacations that we went on, because I remember the beatings, and the violence, and the yelling, and the screaming. And when you tell a young kid at 8 years old, 9 years old, you'll never amount to nothing and you're a piece of shit, you know, that stuff, after a while, you know, you start to believe that old idea that you're a piece of garbage. I wonder why so many of us come in here with damaged goods, just from the unrelenting voices that we hear growing up. And that's not for everyone. I know some of you guys came from tremendous homes. So you could put daddy issues, you could make this mommy issues, you could make whatever kind of issues. The idea here is I had to see truth. I had to see the truth about that relationship with my father to get free and challenge the belief system that I really believed about him. And as I watched that thing at my cousin's house with all this family around, I couldn't stop crying. I think my cousin even said to my other cousin, is he drinking again? Because the truth was being revealed to me right there. I couldn't deny the truth. My old man was crazy, but yeah, he took care of his family. He was a provider. He did things. I just couldn't see it because I was blocked by the walls that we build, the walls of victimization. You blame my father too if you had my life, right? I learned it here, man. In order to get free, I got to see the truth about my anger, my resentments, my grievances, you know? I was always told if any of that's going on, three things are going on. I'm taking everything personal. Yeah, I always do that. I'm either blaming someone for how I feel. I always do that. But more importantly, the biggest delusion that we all live in here sometimes is that life is controllable. And I think I can control life. And I think I can control this relationship. And so I'm in trouble all the time with this stuff. You know, Christmas is next week, even though I don't feel like it's Christmas out here. How do you guys do it? It's kind of weird. I don't know. We left 8 inches of snow on Monday and 15 degrees. I mean, it was Christmas, you know? Come out here, it's vacation. Golf, and this golf in December. Who knew? I didn't say good golf. I should have said golf in December. After my dad died, my mom always wanted to put grave blankets down at the cemetery on the headstone. My father, my grandparents, her sister. And I'm the only one that's living in New Jersey. Like I said, everyone's gone, so my mom would call me up, please, let's take me to the cemetery. And, you know, you go to the place and you buy that overpriced plastic thing you put on a grave, you know, for Christmas. And I would take her up to this northern New Jersey, and we'd go there. It'd always be bitter cold, you know, and I'd take my mother out to the headstone, and it was a challenge just to find it half the time, but we found it, you know, and, you know, say a little prayer, and, you know, and then we get in the car, my truck, and we pull out of the cemetery, and there's a strip mall right next to the cemetery, and there's a Dunkin' Donuts in there, and my mom, like Clockwork, would always say to me, can you go into that Dunkin' Donuts? I knew she was going to ask, go into Dunkin' Donuts, because I have to go to the bathroom. And then when we got into the Dunkin' Donuts, can you get me a small coffee and a jelly donut? Like routine. I'm telling you, 20 years I did that, right? After my mom died, I'm in a meditation one day, and my heart's being pulled. I didn't go to the cemetery for a few years. You know, I'm like, screw that. I'm not doing that. I'm not spending money like that to pay to put that stupid stuff up. Like, I was just so negative about it all. But I'm in this meditation. My heart's being moved in my mind. I keep on saying, go to the grave. The voice in my head is saying, go to the grave. Go to the grave. Go to the grave. And I was trying to deny that sound, but then all of a sudden I came out of it and I grabbed my wife. I said, this has been going on for like 2 or 3 days. This voice is saying, go to the grave. She goes, Jimmy, just pay attention to it. And so I get my truck and I go to the place and I buy the overpriced crap that I'm going to put on the gravesite. And I drive up to North Jersey and I see the headstone, and for the first time, I see my mother's name on the headstone. And some sort of reality hit me. See, I want to blame my parents for everything and who I became, who I become, you know? I want to blame them for my alcoholism. I want to blame them for my failures at life. I want to blame them for everything. And again, I couldn't see the truth. But when I saw my parents' name on that headstone, something happened to me where all of a sudden I broke down and I stopped crying. Couldn't stop crying. And as I left that cemetery, you know, I was going to come home. But my truck had a mind of its own, and the steering wheel just turned into this strip mall. And when I pulled into the strip mall, there was a Dunkin' Donuts there. I didn't want to go in that Dunkin' Donuts. I didn't need a cup of coffee. But all of a sudden, I'm walking into that Dunkin' Donuts. And I didn't have to go to the bathroom, but all of a sudden, I'm in the bathroom taking a leak. And all of a sudden, I'm getting a small coffee, and I'm buying a jelly donut. And I don't even like jelly donuts. And I'm walking out like a zombie, almost like I'm like in a blackout. And I get back in my truck, and I put my head on the wheel of the truck, and I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't stop crying. The reality of my life was right in front of me. Old belief systems were shattered. The way I thought it was, wasn't. And the enormity of walking into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous has shown me a way to get to that transformation and to live a thing called forgiveness. Because there's an old line that we use in here once in a while, and my old sponsor was really good at that. It's a consideration. It's really not a question that I need answered, or you don't need to answer. Consideration is just something maybe I need to bring into reflection. Contemplate about, maybe write some inventory about it. It's an old thing. You guys probably heard this before. But it really made me look at things differently. This guy's the sponsor said to me one day, Jimmy, I want you to consider this. Do you look at the people in your life, the situations in your life, or the circumstances of your life through the lens of a character defect or through the eyes of God? I've been looking at people in my life, my old man, everyone, the situations in my life, everything. All the things that have happened in my life, I've been looking at that stuff with anger, fear, jealousy, envy, selfishness. I mean, you name the character defect. That's how I viewed reality. That was my reality, how I viewed life in a negative way. But something happened to me. I met you. I found a God of my own understanding. I went through these 12 steps, and I started to bring the walls down. And I started to see truth. And one of the things I know that today, on most days, I could see things, people, situations, circumstances through the eyes of God. I could look at people with compassion. I look at the attributes that he did have. My old man was a hard worker. I became a hard worker when I did work. I didn't know how to use a screwdriver. My old man taught me every tool there ever was. I could build a house, well, not today, but, you know, there was a time when I could build anything. My father taught me how to do that. My father taught me how to have organizational skills and put things together and plan out, not just try to be somewhat compulsive, which I can be. Right? There was a lot of things that my old man did that I couldn't see because of my hatred and my heart for this guy. And that would never have happened if I didn't let go of those baby ideas, those baby elephant ideas. You see, that's the opportunity we all have in here. But more importantly, not only about that, it's about what kind of dad have I become. I got two kids. I got a son. My son is 33 years old. My son is very, very, very successful. He's a project manager for a financial company out of London. He's making a lot of money, little bastard. I remember once he said to me, not too long ago, like last year, I think, his printer. I said, go buy one. You could buy 10 printers. He goes, no, I'm going to send you an email. Just print off. It's my taxes. I'm like, okay. And anyway, I knew he was making good money. And so I didn't have the tray in, so the paper was dropping on the floor. So I bent down, and I caught how much money he made last year. I don't know if I was pissed or happy for him, but he made more money in a year than I made 5 years put together. I mean, but I was proud of him. And why I'm proud of him? Because all I ever did for my son was give him what my father tried to give to me without all the nonsense that I created in my mind. My son's a hard worker. My son just bought a house, has a baby, one-year-old baby. I've been showing my son how to use tools and how to fix things without having to call somebody and pay out the cash. Even simple things, right? Little electrical box here, this here, you know? But I look at my son and I say, man, this guy's a fine young man. If I didn't have this, if I didn't have you, if I didn't have a God of my own understanding, if I wasn't willing to walk into the darkness of my life and start to uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking me from him, he would never have a shot. He might be in his room right now if we were lucky. And now I'm a granddad. And now I watch how he is with his one-year-old. And we got a five-month-old. I got a three-year-old. I mean, we got a lot. My kids have turned into rabbits, I swear to Christ. I mean, there's babies popping out left and right all of a sudden. And I love it. And I love it. And I could have all missed all of that because of the rage and anger I had towards my father. Now, again, that could be into any direction you want to take it if you're sitting out there. And whether it's mommy issues or daddy issues or grandparent issues or sibling issues, whatever it is, I had to learn how to forgive. I had to learn how to look at this thing with truth. I had to uncover and discover those old ideas that were blocking me from the truth. And that process takes time. It's not an overnight matter. But man, the one thing I really, really appreciate is your meditation today. You brought me to my first meeting today. That coffee pot was on the left-hand side when I walked in that door. That literature rack you talked about was right across the room. Richie Schnorr's face popped up right when you said that. He was a boilermaker. I think that's what you called it back then, a boilermaker. Steam fitter, whatever that is. A lot of hot air. I don't know what it was. But he brought me back to day one. And I stand here proudly saying something I could never say to myself, is that I love me. Thank you. Oh.
What's happening, boys? My name is Tommy T. I'm still an alcoholic. And like Jimmy, I'd like to start out with a prayer, just not for you guys, it's for me, just to get me into a place that I'm not all about me. So I was nervous speaking at this Appalachian Roundup last year. And I was asked to do steps 8 and 9, and everybody before me was just killing it. There was about 1,000 people there, and I'm just like, I'm not good enough. What am I doing here? This is the same mantra I always tell myself. And I was sitting with a California girl, Arsene, and she said, I only have one of these left, but here, I want you to have it. Why don't you say it a couple times before you go on? And she gave me Butch's card, and I laminated and put it in my big book, because I read that prayer twice. And with me, fellas, fear shows up as like a tightness of chest, and it just left me. I went up there and killed it that day. I mean, that's what they said, you know. But when I saw her just recently, I said, I want to show you something. And I showed it my book, and then it was laminated in the front. We both just cried. Those moments we get here, the people we meet here, you're going to hear that over and over from me and Jimmy today, because we are, if nothing else comes out of this weekend, fellas, you got to know that we love Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys and everything you guys do for us and putting the time in that you do. It's amazing. But Butch's prayer goes something like this. It's very brief. God, I believe there's a path for wherever I am to wherever I need to go, that I will be given the light to find that path, that I will be given the strength to follow it one day at a time, that I will enjoy the journey and be myself when I arrive. Simple stuff that touches our hearts, like a meditation by an old-timer in the morning. 10 minutes in today, I made a noise, and Mike Powers said, you sound like a little dog. I was like, poo-hoo-hoo. You know, I was like, oh, man. I said, where is this going to go this weekend? This is not going to be pretty. But, yeah, Jimmy and I had similar fathers, and we learned a lot of stuff. Sometimes we don't see what the blessings are when we're learning them, or we don't like the way they're being taught to us. You know, my dad had this disease and never found Alcoholics Anonymous. When I hear Larsine speak, I cry because I wish my mother would have found it. You know, that stuff that I saw when I was a kid, I saw my father rape my mother. I saw my father beat my mother. My father beat us. My father didn't even remember doing it the next day. We go through a lot of stuff, and we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we think we're the only people that have been through it. And we find out, no, it's more than half the room. On a good day. And, but we do some self-evaluation. We get that dreaded fourth step. Everybody dreads the fourth step. Don't dread the fourth step if you know. It's one of the greatest things I've ever done in my life. Because it starts breaking down those lies. Those lies that we tell ourselves that we're the victim. And this is that. That's okay. You know, if you're a 12-year-old victim, you're a victim. You don't have much chance at that point. But when you're 35 and blaming your whole life on your father, who really hasn't been in your life for a lot of years, you got to take a look at that stuff. You know, so I told you guys last night I had 31 resentments for my father. And I put everything down that I could remember. You know, I actually use one when I'm taking a guy into the third column of the fourth step. Because my father told me that I was a product of a broken condom when I was about 10 in the backyard. It's really what you want to find out, that, you know, you weren't even wanted. And you know, that affected my self-esteem. Nobody was there, so it didn't affect my pride. But it affected my security. It affected my ambitions. It affected my personal relations and my sex relations, because a man shouldn't talk to his son that way. You know, it didn't affect my pocketbook. But when he announced that story at the bar when I was 16, and we could go to the bar with our fathers and drink back then, even though it wasn't legal, And he told that whole story in front of a crowded bar. Well, now it affected my pride. So it affected all those personal relationships. Now all my friends know I'm not, I wasn't wanted. Those kind of things just scarred me, for lack of a better word. You know. I remember sitting and doing homework at the table, and my father would be drinking a beer, and I would write a whole page, whether it was a report or something that we had to do, and I would just go over one line. With back then, it was cursive. It's kind of like a secret code to the young guys. But it was a script, and you better have been good at it, you know? And he'd say, write that page again. Write it again. I could just erase it. That it's a pencil. No, you can't. You got to write it again. And I would just seethe looking at this guy. Like, I got to write this shit again. And I would write it. And I couldn't get up from that table until it was done, done perfectly. Hated that. You know, back then they had like encyclopedia salesmen and dictionary salesmen that would come to the house, and they'd actually let them in, and they might even buy one if they were feeling generous. And we had a Webster's Dictionary, huge thing, up on a stand in the den. And I would say, Dad, what's that word mean? We're watching TV. He'd say, go look it up. I just bought a dictionary. Oh, jeez. He would never tell me. I used to get so mad at stuff like that. So mad at that. He taught me how to use tools. But if I gave him the wrong wrench, I got that wrench thrown at me. I got hit in the head with it a couple of times. You know? I'm a junior. I'm Tommy T. Jr. Tom Taracco Sr. was my father. He gave me a career. I didn't think it was a career. I thought it was a janitor's job when he gave it to me. And he gave me all the worst jobs in the school system. You know, if there was hot wax to be stripped off the baseboards and it was 90 degrees in August, I'm on my hands and knees doing it. The rest of the guys are having beers in the restroom and I'm out there doing this stuff. Somebody at work gets trouble, they might get a little letter in their file. I get pulled out into the hallway and just get blown up in front of everybody. I hate him. Couldn't stand him. But he would take me into those schools on the weekends, and he would say, I'm going to teach you something today. And then we'd go in, he'd run the boiler a little bit for hot water, and they'd say, oh, you got to clean it now. What do you mean I got to clean it? I'm a janitor. I don't go in a boiler room. I would try to fight him with it. And I'd put on the Tyvek suit, and I'd crawl in a hot boiler, and I'd be wire brushing soot down and everything, and he'd be out there with a beer. Make sure you get all the spots. Before I'd come out, the sweat's pouring off you. He'd go in with a flash, back in the back there. You missed some. I'm telling you, I did everything in my power not to hit him with a monkey wrench when he wasn't looking. But I did it. And just went through like that. When I did those resentments, I had 31 resentments for that old man. One thing came clear to me at that time in my life, that I did become my father. But he was better at it than I was, because I had two sons I didn't know. I knew my father. He stayed. He put food on the table. I didn't even do that. I wasn't man enough to do that, 35 years old. Hit me hard, even before I spoke to my sponsor. But then the sponsors and the men that have been through stuff like this and the men that have gone through all of this before us, we sit there and he started asking me questions. And he said, do you know anything about your father's life? I said, no, a little bit. You know what grandma tells you, what grandpa tells you. But every one of those alcoholic boys left that house at 15 to join the Merchant Marines, every one of them. Every one of them joined the service at 16. Something was going on in that house that they needed to get out of. We don't know exactly what it is, don't know exactly to this day. I thought my grandfather was a bad guy because they lived in different rooms. And I spoke to an elder cousin not too long ago, and he said, nah, Tommy, he was a great guy. Grandma was a religious nut. He says, I think there was some Ray Donovan stuff going on in over there. They were all altar boys and everything. Like, I have no idea what my father went through. But that generation of men just couldn't tell you they loved you. They couldn't hug you. There were no safe spaces. There was no political correctness. There was nothing. You're an asshole, is what you heard from your father. You know, you better get your stuff together because you're not doing well in life, son. And that's how they taught you. I didn't see that. I just hated him. I needed somebody to blame for my miserable existence that I caused. But I didn't even see I caused it. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I was still looking to blame people. You know, we go through that amends process, and he was in my first wave of amends. He was drinking 3 times a day. He would get his load on 3 times a day. He had retired, and he would go to the bar at 7 in the morning, open that place up. He'd be drunk by 11. He'd go home, take a nap, or maybe nap in the booth in the back of the bar. They were doing that back then. Then he'd get drunk up until right before dinner. Maybe have a, we used to call it a chicken dinner. It was a 25-cent hard-boiled egg. That would be his dinner. And then he'd finish off the load and be home by 9 o'clock at night, you know. So you had to get him in a lucid interval. And I went into the bar and made amends to him, and I poured my heart out to him. You know, we were real well-trained, real mechanical in our amends back then. And I said, Dad, I have no idea how much of money I stole and how much I owe you. And he said, it's $12,664. I got it in my book. And they always had the book with a couple of pens in their front pocket, you know. And I said, well, I'm going to pay it all back. And he said, yeah, Russ, I'll believe that when I see it. And right then I said, oh, I'm paying every dollar back. I'm paying every dollar back. So my sponsor then, I was just switching sponsors and went to this guy, Joe. And he said, you got a pretty troubled relationship there. And he said, I want you to under-promise, overpay. Can you do 100 a week? I said, yeah, he's my primary. I want to get this done. And he says, okay. Well, when you can give him a little more, you give him a little more. And keep track of what you're paying him. He said, but I want you to go down to that bar every Saturday and pay him in person. I said, come on, man. This we can transfer money now. Like, this is crazy. You know, I don't. He says, come on. You said you were willing to go to any lengths to get past this. And I said, I am. 11 o'clock for almost 2 years, every single Saturday, I would be down at this place on Forest Avenue on Staten Island. And I would walk in, and there's the same 10 guys at the bar, same old guys. Everybody would say hello to me except for my father. He would just sit there looking at his drink. And I'd say, what's up, Pop? Yeah, how you doing? Sick before that. I did what the AA guys told me to do. I put her in bed every night at 11 o'clock in a hospital bed we had in the house. I put her little Yorkie dog in the bed with her, made sure she had cigarettes and water. I paid out of pocket for a home care nurse for when I went to work. Told my mom I loved her. When she passed, I was holding her hand. She just started saying, I'm going home, son, I'm going home. That hurt me because I was like a mama's boy. You know, I used to stick up for mom when the fights happened and I was big enough and all that. She always took care of me. And I had resentments for my mom because she never left that. We made that all right in the amends process. And I got to hold her hands. And when I say take care of your mom, I mean like changing diapers stuff. It's not easy stuff. But I had men in Alcoholics Anonymous and a sponsor that walked me through that stuff. I was sponsoring a nurse at that point, and I relied on that kid to make the healthcare proxy decisions. I couldn't do it by myself. I didn't know. That stuff scares me. Well, I went to my father, and he happened to be in the hospital at the same time. They were on different floors together, and they were worried that the protection order would be in effect. So, yeah, it's a little dysfunctional. And I went up, and I told my father, Mom passed away. And he said, oh, it's like a scratch-off. I said, what do you mean? He said, I got to pay that old hag $1,800 a month. I just got $1,800 a month for life. I just wanted to tell you that. I love you. Bye. I walk out. 35 days later, my father gets taken to the hospital. He's got a CPD, whatever that is, with the breath. And he's in an oxygen tank. And my sister's a nurse. She's not there. I got to sit with this guy for 5 hours. I'm holding his hand, and fellas, I was praying, do I put a pillow over his head or not? Because every breath was like the last breath. Then nothing. It was bad. It was bad. When we laid him out, I went up to the coffin when everybody else left. And I said, well, Dad, congratulations on the scratch-off, but you're only getting one payment. That's how I said goodbye to my father. So the inventories came, and it's still on there, and I just can't get past this stuff. And I'm at a place called Usual Suspects. Guy Bob B., I'm sure you guys all know him, dragged me there. And he said, you got to get, you know, branch out a little bit, get around some men that have a little bit more time than you. And I meet this corny guy, Howard P. And man, he was an engineer. He reminded me a little bit of my father. I was like, you know. But I fell in love with that man. And every year I would go to Usual Suspects, a spiritual experience would happen in that place for me. Crazy stuff. Every year something happened. We went into meditation the first time I was there. I saw my son's bottom, clear as day. I saw the room he was in. I'm meditating with like 60 guys, 60 hicks from Tennessee, can't even speak the English language. And they introduced me that year as the international visitor from New York. And they asked if I needed a translator, the whole bit. It was great. And I'm in this meditation, and it's a love meditation, and they're sending love to people, and I'm sending love to my son. And I saw my son with a needle in his arm, and he's saying, I can't stop, I can't stop. I could smell the dope. I know what dope smells like. I could smell the candles they had burning in that shithole he was in. 14 days later, my son showed up at my door and asked me for help, and he's sober 12 years now. But I'm down there the next year, and nothing's happening. I'm like depressed. I'm like, what's going on, man? No white lights, you know? I paid for white lights. Where's the white lights? You know? And it was Bob and Howard were doing the weekend. They go into Sunday, and they do their Big Bang talk. They're talking about, you know, all the atoms and the hydrogen, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm checking out, right? And I'm sitting in the front row with all the heavy hitters. You know, I'm the junior member with, like, 25 years or 24 years, whatever it was at that point. And I'm just sitting there, and all of a sudden Howard gets the mic from Bob. And he said, you know, I'm coming up on almost 80 years old. And I've hated my father for a lot of years. And I don't want to go to the grave that way. He said, I was out in the West Coast in the airport with my friend Clancy. And Clancy was playing country songs on a piano at the airport. And I was singing with him. And he said, you know, my father gave me the love of country music. And he said, when my father was busting up the house or ready to beat us or something, I would hide under the dining room table, and I'd have my little recorder, and I'd listen to some of my old favorites. And he said, you know, if you know Howard, I took that to meditation for 2 hours a day for the next 6 months. I'm like, oh, my God. I'm thinking I'm doing 15 minutes. I'm doing good, you know? And he said, and it came to me, and then he went into, because of the neurotransmitters in your head and this and that and all this stuff. Yeah, neuroplasticity, there you go. And all this stuff. And he said that our bodies are built up that we remember the bad things to protect us from them happening again. So all of a sudden, I perked up a little bit in my chair. And he said, and I really had to meditate and pray on it, and to think about the good things my father did for me. And then he went on to tell a story, and I'll tell it now, and I'll butcher it, but he said, you know, our father, he was the father that used to tell the guys, go out and get a switch off the tree and make sure it's at least this thick. He'd come out, they'd clean the thorns off of it, and that's what they'd get whipped at. These kids had to go get their own beaten, you know? I said, oh, that's a little harsh. And he said, but he wouldn't let us out in the back of the barn for over a year. And he was a hair cutter, didn't have a lot of money. It ends up what that guy was doing back there was he was digging out tree roots and clearing land and leveling that ground and doing everything. And he cut a guy's hair for a year because the guy worked on the highway department and would get the broken poles after there was a bad accident. And he installed that hole, that pole, and bought them a hoop. And he put lime lines down. And he said, and we had a basketball court behind our barn. He said, he picked us up after school. And like my brother looked at me, I looked at him, he said, what's he doing here? He said, I don't know, something's got to be going on. And they got in the car and they didn't even put the seatbelts on because they wanted to be able to jump out. Like they were scared. And his father drove him around with a sense of pride and showed him, look what I did for you boys. Happy birthday. And here's this beautiful basketball court. And he said, We were the envy of the neighborhood. And then he went on to say some other things his dad did for him. And I'm sitting in that front row, and if you thought that, Mike, if you thought that little whimper this morning for Jay's meditation was something, my nose starts running, I start blubbering. I'm sitting right where Mike's sitting. Bob's looking like, what the hell's going on over there? I got this guy, Johnny Edmonds from Maryland. He's rubbing my back like I'm a 90-day newcomer, you know, like, you okay? You okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine, you know. And there's the door, and I just book out the door. I couldn't even stay in the retreat for the final closing session, you know. And I went out, and I hit my knees next to a cross, and I said, oh, God, please help me. I can't live like this. I still hate my father. I got my stuff together. I went back in. Everybody was on the receiving line. They were wishing, you know, thank the guys for a great weekend. And I said, Howard, I was the last on the line. I said, I don't know what happened. And he put his hand on my chest. He said, well, it looks like I broke you open a bit. And I said, yeah, you did. And he said, are you willing to do a little work on this? And I said, sure, I'm willing to do anything. And he said, okay, I want you to start praying and meditating on your dad and really focus on the good stuff. And he says, then I want you to do an inventory, and I want you to call me as soon as you're done with that inventory. And I sat and I prayed. It was probably 4 or 5 days before I wrote it. But when I wrote, that pen took off. God took that pen, as he always does with me. I don't even have this stuff in my mind when I sit down. And then when pen hits paper, there's magic there. And I wrote 47 things down that my father taught me. All of a sudden, I remembered water skiing in Suntan Lake. Lake George up in the cabins, Atlantic City, the steel pier and the diving horse. Remember, Jim? I mean, it was just great. It was just great. Then I took it a little step further, and I realized what a difficult son I was. You know, at 17 years old, a credit card came to the house. I'm a junior. They didn't put junior on it. Bad move. They didn't put senior on it. I'm sorry. I don't even have a real job. I'm not even on the books. I know it's not mine. I signed the back of that bad boy. I grab 4 guys. We rent a van. We go to a punk rock fest up in Canada, up in Mossport, Canada. We stay 8 days. I charge up about $3,700 on that card. And I'm paying for all the meals. Just give me the cash. And then I'm buying drugs with the cash. You know, it was a great trip. Get home. I make like nothing's happening. All of a sudden, the credit card bill comes. I didn't know that's how they work. You know, what the hell is this? I said, what's the problem? They sent me a credit card. I applied for one. It's a lie. And he said, you don't even have a job on the books. Nobody's going to give you a credit card. This guy has a $20,000 limit. You ain't got that kind of credit. I said, well, I didn't look at the limit, Dad. I just went and had some fun. I said, let me see that. Monthly payment of $17? Don't worry about it. I gave him $17. The way that, if this guy didn't kill me that day, you know, later on as a dad, son borrowed my car without asking me. And it was a stepson. Cheryl and I had just gotten married. And it was a Lincoln. You got to understand, it was a Lincoln. It was a nice car. I sat there and I was ready to kill this guy. And all of a sudden, God gave me the thought, well, at least he didn't take your credit card. And when that boy came in, I said, sit down. I need to talk to you. And he said, yeah, what's up? I said, you're not allowed to drive that car. He said, I knew, but there was no. I said, no excuse. You're just not allowed to take that again. Are we clear? And he said, yeah, we're clear. And I didn't ruin that relationship. This boy is kind of tight. You know, his father cut out on him when he was very young. And just this last month, he bought a house. He's been living with us for the last 5 years with 3 grandkids. And me and him have been spending time together doing sheetrock and doing stuff and having the greatest conversations ever. And if I would have missed that, if I would have been the guy that I was going to be, if he would have got home an hour earlier, it would have went a different way. But, you know, I'm the man I am today, good, bad, or indifferent, because of Tom Tarracco Sr. That man taught me a lot. You know, I retired from the Department of Ed after a 45-year career. They fired me for bad behavior in 1996, but I got that job back. I became a boss there. I was cleaning out my desk, and in the bottom of my drawer, I had a Webster's Dictionary. I don't use Google. I don't talk to my phone. You know, I don't even have my phone with me, you know. You should see my penmanship. I'm like a typewriter. I'm telling you. People say, wow, you got some signature. People always comment on it, which is neat. That's all it is. You can read it, you know, because of him. I'm real good with my hands. I had a 45-year career that they're going to pay me the rest of my life for because of my father. You know, sometimes we got to force ourselves to look in a different direction. But why? Because the old direction ain't working. It's causing me and others too much harm. It's the only time I get motivated. Pain's got to get pretty great for me to do something, you know. But for guys like Howard and Bob and some men in this room, and it's all about another man sharpening another man. Because void from my emotions, void from my fears, void from my self-worth or no self-worth, however you want to put it, you guys see something in me that I don't see. But I got to tell you, and I'm not saying that there's a time limit on it or anything. I hope it happens for a lot of guys in this room a lot longer, you know, that it doesn't take as long as it did for me. But I'm starting to believe that I'm a good guy. It's happening. It's slow. I'm a good dad today. I got 3 stepkids. My son's my best friend, Brett. He's 39. Those 3 grandkids, every time they look at me, I just melt. I'm crying a lot lately. I don't know where that's coming from. It's a little sloppy. I'm not real happy about it, but my wife thinks it's hot, but you know, she's just crazy. But fellas, the stuff that we do here, my experience is it's always gotten better. There's a line in our book that says, the greatest years of your existence lie ahead. And I believe that's as true for the new guys that raised their hand the other night and the guys here with 40 years, 45 years, whatever it is. Just how willing are you to seek it? Are you willing to look at places you haven't looked before? The answers are there. Greatest promise in the big book, all our problems are of our own making. But we can do something about that. But you need a guide. You need friends that love you enough to tell you the truth when you're not seeing things right. That's been my experience here. And that's what I got on Daddy Issues. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions, toll free 1-877-893-2777, or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.